Retina Rounds, podcast number 4. In today's episode, Stephen Schwartz interviews Dr. Mark Blumenkrantz, an innovator as a clinician, surgeon, and department chair. Dr. Blumenkrantz founded the Retina Fellowship Training Program at Beaumont Eye Institute and served as a chair of the Department of Ophthalmology at Stanford University, where he helped to plan, fundraise, and construct the Byers Eye Institute. Here he talks about his career path and what it means to be a true innovator in medicine. Let's check it out.
Greetings to all of our listeners. It's a great pleasure today to have with us one of the true giants in retina for our Giants in Retina series, Dr. Mark Blumenkrantz. Mark, welcome, and thank you for joining us.
Glad to be here, Steve. Always good to see you.
You too. Thank you very, very much. Mark's bio is remarkable to the point that we're not going to go through it all, but he's been the president of just about every bit of organized ophthalmology, Retina Society, Macular Society. He's won just about every award. Great surgeon, great innovator, great leader, great friend, and a real pioneer in our field. And so today it's really a thrill, Mark, to have you with us. If you can, let's start out with how you came to be in ophthalmology. I know you had choices. And what was it formatively for you that drove you into or lured you into ophthalmology to all of our benefit?
Well, as you asked, you know, I actually always wanted to be an ophthalmologist because I thought it was had the best combination of sort of just elegance as a field, you know, just the eye is so beautiful. The science is so good. The surgery is so technically demanding. And so that's what I wanted to do. But I, in my third year of medical school, I sort of became enamored of being a blood and guts surgeon. And I looked around and I really admired the surgeons that I saw. And I said, well, the eye's awfully small and limited. Maybe I'll just be a surgeon instead. And so I started out as a surgical resident at Stanford, but I had done my away rotations around the country. And I went to Bascom-Palmer and I met Dr. Mockamer. And I, at that point, I was kind of interested in ophthalmic plastic surgery. And I thought, well, it's just too limiting. I'll be a general surgeon. But in the course of my internship, I realized that I really missed ophthalmology. And that's what I wanted to do. And I spoke to the folks at Stanford, where I was in the residency program, and they said, we'll take you if you want to do it. And I said, okay, it's a deal. And that's, so I tried other things, but at the end of the day, I just had always been in love with ophthalmology, and that's, I'm so glad that I made that decision.
So are we, and how did you land on retina?
Well, it was interesting. You know, as I mentioned, I sort of was leaning towards oculoplastic surgery. But it's at Stanford, it was a very small department when I was there. There were only, I believe, 3 full-time faculty members. And at that point, there actually wasn't a full-time retinal specialist. They were, in that era, you know, in the mid-70s, a lot of ophthalmic departments, especially the smaller ones, and even the larger ones, had positions called geographic full-time, where you could be in private practice and you would donate a certain amount of your time to teaching. And we still have that now, but usually it's a half day a week if you're in private practice. But Doctors Little and Zwang and Bob Jack were in a well-regarded retinal practice. And they were, well, actually, Dr. Zwang and Little were actually the inventors of the slit lamp delivery system for the laser. And they were, they worked very closely with SRI, very closely with Coherent, that was just a little baby company, you know, in Palo Alto. And they were amongst the 4 or 5 best laser experts in the United States in ophthalmology. So I had a firsthand look at what was going on. This is pre, you know, ETDRS and pre-MPS and all that. And I used to carry the bunnies over to the office to do teaching, and people would come from all over the country to see this argon laser system and a slit lamp delivery system, and they taught courses. And I thought, this is awfully cool, you know, I like this. And so I decided to switch from being an oculoplastic surgeon to being a retinal surgeon. It stayed with me. Dr. Zwang never gets enough credit. He was this very suave, debonair, handsome, charismatic guy And he just said, "Oh, isn't it wonderful?" And he was always positive and high energy. And he really was the, I would say, one of the principal catalysts for people switching over from the xenon arc to the argon laser before it had been shown to be effective, even in the DRS study results. And I thought, and he was a tennis player, and he was just so smart and charming, and he'd written a book on lasers, and he published papers, and I thought, gee, I would, he's somebody that I would really like to emulate. And Dr. Mike Marmer was also at Stanford at that time, and he had a, you know, a different persona, is, you know, much more academic and rigorous and more serious, I guess. And I really admired his science. And I thought, gee, I could, there's a lot I could learn from both these guys. And they were both tennis players too. And I loved to play tennis. And so we were all chummy. And it just seemed like a natural thing that I'd become a retinal specialist and probably get involved with the laser. And here we are all these years later. And a lot of that came to pass, I guess.
Sure did. And so as you were choosing your fellowship, what criteria did you use to choose? Obviously, you had pick of the litter, and there were some really good places you could have gone, and you landed where you landed. Talked about that. What criteria you chose, you used to choose?
Yeah, well, this was the prehistoric era. There wasn't even a matching program. So at that point, it was you'd go around and introduce yourself, and people would look you over and say, he or she seems like a good person, and you sort of had an idea of where you wanted to go, but you didn't get the envelope, you know, in the spring that said where you were going to go, and so you sort of had to be a deal maker. Now, I always wanted to go to Bascom-Palmer. Because I'd gone there as a medical student, as a visiting medical student, and I was just so impressed with the fact that there was a, you know, a whole building devoted to ophthalmology. There weren't many places, you know, Willmar and Mass Eye and Ear and Jules Stein, but there weren't a ton, you know, of, and I had it in my head I wanted to go there, but it was kind of like a rolling basis, and I thought, well, maybe, and the only thing that was concerning me was that Dr. Machmer had just left to go from there to Duke to become chairman of the department, and Duke was a very, very small department, sort of like Stanford was in those days, not the juggernaut that it is now. And so I had to sort of wait as I went to interviews and see who offered me a spot, and then if I got that spot, then I would call the other place that had offered me a spot that was a little bit lower on my list, and I'd say, well, I'm going to go somewhere else, and you can release my spot. And so it was really kind of a strange system where you were all, everybody was in play, the departments were in play, the candidates were in play, and you just really never knew to the last day, you know, what where you were going to end up. And so I did have good choices of Hopkins and Mass Eye and Ear and USC and Duke. And Bascom-Palmer, but I decided that Bascom-Palmer for me had the best balance of medical retina because we had Dr. Gass there at the time and surgical retina. Even though Machmer had left, there was John Clarkson and Harry Flynn. Harry Flynn was a junior faculty member. Gary Abrams was a junior faculty member. You know, these are obviously giant people in our field, but at that time they were just a year or two out of training, and but they really had wonderful way about them, and the resident I spoke to the most, the fellow I should say, was Stan Chang, and I thought, this is, he's really a nice guy. He'll probably be going places someday, and if I could go where he is, and he chose it, then I suppose I'll do it too. And they all loved it there, so that's how I ended up at Bascom-Palmer.
So besides Stanley Chang, who else did you overlap with in your training?
Oh my, so many different people, really.
It was such a hotbed cauldron of leadership at the time.
Yeah, well, of course, all those faculty, and my year, I think I ended up being the only academician, but the next year, the year after that, you know, I ended up training a lot of people, even, and I was younger. I'd skipped a year of medical school and sort of a year of high school or of school. So most of the people I trained for a number of years were older than I was, and it's sort of odd that I was in a position of being the, you know, the more senior person. But Don DiMicco came. Bill Mueller was my first resident. You know, I was his principal advisor, and just a whole host. Eddie Alfonso, who's chairman there, of course, now was a resident when I was there, and a lot of names that won't be household names, but that you would remember, people like Randy Campo, and it was just full of people. And I
Spectacular.
became very close to Harry Flynn and Gary Abrams there. We were kind of the young bucks. George Blankenship was there at the time, and just anyway.
Just amazing, amazing pedigree. And as you did you end up staying on the faculty at Bascom for a while?
I did, yeah. I had an interest in ultrasound, and Gary had decided that he was going to go back to Milwaukee, and Gary was doing the ultrasound for them, and I think Dr. Norton took a liking to me, and Vic Curtin took a liking to me, and Harry and John Clarkson and others, Don Gass, and so they asked me if I wanted to stay, and I said sure. And in those days, fellowships were generally 1 year, sometimes 2 years, but Gary was leaving, and they needed somebody right away. So I ended up, I don't really tell people this, but I ended up really with only 9 months of my fellowship. They let me join the faculty, and then I had like restrictions on what I could do surgically for another 3 months, just because, I guess for legal reasons. And I did ultrasound there for a number of years for them, but the whole time I wanted to, I still wanted to, I wanted to do research, and Mockamer had just left the year before, so they had a big lab there that was being not being used at the McKnight building, and they said, "Would you like this lab?" And I said, "Yeah, that would be great." And I went up there, and it was just full of people that had worked with Dr. Mockamer, and the ORs were full of people that had worked with Dr. Mockamer. And anytime I would do anything, they'd always look at me and they'd say, "Dr. Mockamer would never do it that way." And I'd say, "Well, Dr. Mockamer's gone, and I'm here now, and we're gonna do it this way, And you're just walking in the shadow of giants. They didn't have a full office for me. They were short on office space. And so Don Gass had such a massive slide collection, of glass slides and also, ektachromes, Kodachromes, that he took an extra half of the adjacent office to him. And so they gave me the other half that wasn't being used. So I was kind of like a tenant farmer there, living in this small little room, and it sort of signified my status, which was at that point pretty low, relative to some of these giant figures. But it was more than adequate, and I got to go in and talk to Don whenever I had a question about stuff, and so it was kind of funny to be amongst all those people that I just looked up to for so many years, and now I was on the faculty, but I still felt like a very junior person in those days.
And then from Bascom, you went to.
I went to Royal Oak, Michigan. It was interesting. I just loved being at Bascom Palmer. Norton and Curtin and Gass and Flynn and Clarkson there were two Flynns, Harry and John Flynn, pediatric ophthalmologist, and they all treated me so well. But I felt sort of kind of growing pains. I had it in my head that I wanted to have a clinical research institute, and at that point, it was kind of hard to get it through the administration, and I had a family, I had a child, and in those days, academic salaries were very, very low. We're talking five figures, for a lot of people, and my wife Risa was anxious to get back to the Northeast, where her family was from, and so the guys at Royal Oak made me a proverbial offer I couldn't refuse. They said I could bring my postdoc with me and have a lab and do clinical research and do lab research and have a much more affordable housing and also a healthier salary, and get a lot of surgical experience. And so I took it, and I had spent 7 really happy years in Royal Oak. Really, at that point, they didn't have a fellowship, and part of the agreement was that if I went there, they would let me start a fellowship, because I wanted to continue to train fellows, and they were involved in a lot of multi-center clinical trials, but they weren't, and they but they didn't weren't training fellows, and that was part of the deal, and also that I could have a lab, and they gave me lab space too. So I felt like I was still in academic medicine, even though it wasn't a university department. And it was, I suppose, I was one of the early vanguard of people that moved from academic programs out into the private sector and still tried to maintain some sort of visibility and influence, even though I wasn't in an academic program. And obviously things are quite different now, but now it's, you have your choice of what you want to do. But in those days it was considered, oh, ooh, he's leaving academics. He will never be heard from again, so anyway, everybody, I had people on both sides saying, great idea, or you'll be really sorry. And I didn't know how it's going to turn out, obviously, but it's okay. Turned out reasonably well.
I would say it's okay. Yeah, it turned out to be amazing. And I know you've told me over and over again that academia is not defined by the building.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think there are plenty of, very academic private practices, and there are some academic practices that are primarily clinical, and it's really all about what you want to do, what you're comfortable doing, what the resources are that are available, and the choices that you make as to what you want to do. Certainly, right now, it's really hard to make much of a distinction between the academic surgeons and the private practice surgeons in terms of workload, publication history, you name it. Maybe a little bit less in terms of committee memberships and grant writing, but other than that, I think everybody's kind of doing the same job, and they just it's almost a matter of where you want to live and kind of whether you want to have that robe and that fancy hat and march in a parade, every June or so. But I've been comfortable on both sides of it.
And you've gone back and forth. And so from Royal Oak, you went to Stanford, and it was a little bit like coming home again. And tell us a little bit about what it was like when you took over at Stanford and how you built that department. For those of you who aren't aware, when Mark came back to Stanford, it was a very fine department, but it's gone from being a very fine department to a world-leading department, and with its own building and endowments and chairs and huge contributions to our field. And so how did you make that decision? That was a real leap of faith.
Yeah, well, it was interesting. That was actually a really hard decision for me to go back to Stanford. I absolutely love Stanford as an institution, as a university, as a way of thinking about things. And I was really in many ways not fully happy not being there. Once I spent my internship and residency years there, I kind of knew what it represented, and at that time, it was just a shadow of what it is now. The Silicon Valley was—they still had apricot orchards, in large parts of what now are massive tech companies. But when I went back, it was a hard decision because I just love my partners, Mike Tracy and Ray Margerio and George Williams, and I mean, it was, my best friend, amongst my best friends in the world. And so leaving them was Mort Cox. It was really a hard thing. And, I was economically pretty secure there. My father-in-law told me I was crazy. I'd be poor, being an academician again. But I really felt like I could contribute more being in Palo Alto, and having access to Silicon Valley and the university. And so I just made a leap of faith, and I went back. And it was a very good department, but it wasn't a great department because it was very, very small. It still only had about four or five full-time faculty. It was on a back hallway of the old Boswell building, which was the old Stanford Hospital, and very poor in resources, no grants, no functioning labs at that particular point in time. And so there was a lot of work to be done, a lot of wood to be chopped. And so we did it gradually. I had a vision for the department, which I continue to believe is the right way for young chairs to do it, which is, there's always this big question: does great science yield great medicine, or does great medicine yield great science? And the answer is it's not that simple. It's kind of a It's kind of a circular argument, but if you had to start somewhere, and I learned this from Dr. Norton at Bascom Palmer, who was really an important mentor for me. He had built the Eye Institute from nothing, and so I thought to myself, well, it's not exactly the same, but it was a similar type of situation. You have to start with really getting the very best clinicians, because if you do that, the patients will trust you, the patients will come, they'll support you in your other missions, like science. And so we did it that way. When I first got there, I wasn't chair. I was head of the retina service, and I had an unusual hybrid arrangement. I was, reasonably well known, and they wanted someone to come that could help them build up the department. And so I came, and I spent half my time at the university, and half of my time at a private practice in Palo Alto. In fact, it was the old Zwang little Jack practice. But a new dean came into town, and he said that I had to choose between being at the university and being in private practice, and that they would wanted me to be the chairman of the department. And I had never intended to be a department chair, never thought about it before. But I was faced with this decision, not that if I either had to come full time at Stanford or leave Stanford, and they would get somebody else, and I'd be back in private practice again. And I thought that really wasn't why I moved back there, because I wanted to be part of Stanford. So I took the job. The package was appallingly small in retrospect. I mean, it was really a small package, and I was sort of left on my own to try to marshal resources, one at a time. But we got there, and I think it was with that idea. First we got really was able to recruit some very fine young clinicians. I couldn't go after free agents because I didn't have the resources, space, or capital resources to do it. But the young surgeons all turned out to be pretty capable, and so now most of them are household names, but they weren't at the time. And little by little, we got donors to help, and of course, the principal person that's been my partner now for more than 30 years was Brooke Byers, who we sort of built a friendship. He took a liking to me. Initially, he tells everybody he saw me as a patient. We talked. I told him I had a vision that Stanford's department was not commensurate with the size and the prestige of Stanford as a university. And I thought that was, and then we didn't have an institute, and we needed to have an institute like Jules Stein, like you were at, or Bascom Palmer. And I said we could do it, but I needed help, and he agreed to help me build consensus in the community. And so we did that over a period of about 8 years or so. And then we started on plans for the building, and in 2010 we opened the Byers Eye Institute. And so it's been a huge, I think it's been a huge benefit, certainly for the department, and being able to attract more resources, people, capital resources, research, and so forth. And also for our community, we didn't really have, at least on the peninsula, we had UCSF up the road, but it's a little bit, people are a little bit parochial about where they go for their care. And Silicon Valley wanted to have their own Silicon Valley place to go, and that was Stanford. And so we built a pretty good following over a period of years. And but that
Let's talk about let's sorry for interrupting. Let's talk about how you chose your junior faculty and sort of a high level synthetic, as some of our listeners are applying to jobs and they're trying to decide where to go. So this is really informative. And of course, your trajectory is something that people can really only dream about now, but dreaming is healthy, and some of us will get there. And so, but how did you what did you look for? You've trained not only at Stanford, not only great residents, but great fellows, and you've really been sort of a wizard at choosing faculty. And so, can you just speak to what you look for, the criteria or the characteristics you look for, both in residency selection, which I know you're less involved in now, and fellowship selection, and then, of course, faculty selection?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. I pay a lot of attention to personal qualities and character. in picking people. Like I said, I didn't have a huge package to work with or to offer to people. So I had to think about what was I offering. And in a sense, the department at the very beginning was not resource intensive. We didn't have a lot of money. I didn't have a lot of money to offer in salary. We didn't have wonderful space, I would say. We were on campus. That was nice. But and so I had to try to sell people on the idea, which was what attracted me to Stanford, which was that it was just a great place. It was an amazing place that was where the history of the world was being written. And if you were there, you could be part of that story, whether it was, Yahoo or Sun Microsystems or Google. And you were just surrounded by people that were world beaters, and that had to be important to you. If it was about the salary or the size of your office or the size of your package, then it wasn't really that good a place. And so I got young people who were hungry, who wanted to prove things to me. One of the first guys I got was Daniel Palanker, who we ended up who was on his way to Harvard. He already had an appointment there in the laser lab there, and I just happened to see him randomly through a patient interaction, and I saw that he was a very special scientist in person, and I convinced him to stay. And I couldn't quite match the offer, and in those days, Stanford Vision Science was not Harvard, but he stayed and he helped build the department. And then I met our mutual friend Ed Manchie. We needed a refractive surgeon. Even as I was just assuming the chair, we needed to get a corneal specialist to replace somebody who had left. And Ed was just a young buck. He was a fellow at Jules Stein, right? And but he had that spark, that energy, that kind of drive. And he said, "If you hire me, you will not regret it." And he'd come from kind of a smallish Northeastern program, not one of the big principal ones, but I could see that he was just smart and energetic and committed, and he turned out to be a great hire. Ed's obviously he's not in retina, but he's one of the top refractive surgeons in the United States for sure. And he was really from the first day he came. So I think it was finding, Darius Mashfeghi and Steve Stanislaw, and so many young people came, and all of whom are household names now. But I think it was qualities, it was ca good character, hardworking, honest, energetic, wanting to make a difference. And so, in a way, I avoided people who were trying to come out to what we call the farm and sort of finish up their career there and have good weather and kind of be able to, bicycle and go to the beach or whatever. So we attracted a certain, I would say, phenotype, and just one by one. So I think it's about finding people that are a good fit, and who are willing to play it well in the sandbox and have dreams of their own and have a vision that they want to that you can help them realize. And so I always tell people when they ask, where should I go? What should I do? I say, well, one thing is you got to decide who you want to be. Do you want to be sort of on the private side or academic? And secondly, where do you want to live and raise your family? And that's just equally important. And if you know what both of those are, you can usually find a match or a fit somewhere. But I do tell young people that it is easier to move from academia into the private sector than from the private sector into academia. So for those of you that are harboring ambitions of doing that, of eventually going into academic medicine, better to start there and see if it's to your liking, and then if not, to move out versus trying to go the other direction. It's possible, and many people have done it, and I sort of, and you could say I did it because I was in and out and then back in again. But I think it's a little easier. But I think, yeah, where you live is really important. And if you're a freshwater fish and you're in a saltwater pond, or if you're a saltwater tropical fish and you're living in the cold water fresh water somewhere, and you're not happy, you're not going to be productive. And at the end of the day, you may end up feeling the need to change. So I think getting a fit, where you can live and be comfortable, raise your family, make a reasonable living. But I don't think money's the object. I think it's really living out your life the way you want to live out your life. And I think compensation is important. It's not unimportant, but I wouldn't put it as being anywhere near the top of my what I consider when I do things. I think that success is a byproduct of utility. If you're a person that contributes and to your whatever department or practice you're in, and you'll do well. I mean, you'll either be rewarded there, or you will have the opportunity to go somewhere else and be rewarded for being that way. But chase, certainly chasing dollars. And some people said, "Oh, Mark, it's leaving for economic reasons when I left Miami." But it wasn't true. I was in those days, Miami, it had some social issues, related to it was a very tough time for the city. And it's funny when you go now and you see how beautiful the city is and how well run and vibrant. And it's hard to believe that, in the days of the boat lift and the riots and things, it was a tough place. But people saw beyond that and stayed and helped build a great city. And I think that's a key learning for me, is that, if it's something, if a place is not what you want, and it's within your power to make it what you want, then do that. And if it's outside your power, or you don't feel up to it, then it's reasonable to go somewhere where you feel it's a better fit already, and you can be comfortable.
Great,
Whether
great thoughts. Shifting gears, Mark, to training. You've trained so many great people. And I know you haven't been operating for a couple of years now, but think back for us about sort of high-level surgical principles and clinical principles that you always imparted. I know there were a lot, but if you can pull back and share with us three or four or five surgical principles, clinical principles, how to approach patient, informed consent, when the surgery starts, respect the tissues. I mean, you were such an elegant surgeon and really defined a lot of the procedures we do, brought them I'll never forget at some academy, we were sitting there and together, and I watched three or four of the really great surgeons in the country come up to you and present complicated surgical questions, and you were just handling it one after another. So share a little bit the synthesized high-level teachings that you wanted to see all of your trainees develop before we get into anything specific, if we do at all.
Yeah, it's a good th yeah, it's a good question, and I have to think about it for a sec. But I would say the first thing is to really understand what you're undertaking as a surgeon, and be sure that it's the right answer for the patient to operate. Because sometimes, so that's knowing the natural history of a disease, and sort of knowing the natural history of a disease after a surgical intervention, and recognizing, being able to advise the patient that what's in their own best interest. I think a number of things are really, really important. I think you have to be a really, really good, I mean, you obviously, it goes without saying, you have to have decent hands. You don't want to have a tremor, but those things are givens. I think a lot of it is respecting tissue, and understanding that it's kind of like woodworking or something, where there's a grain to things and there's a feel to things, and realizing, first of all, who needs to be operated on and who probably should be observed for a while. The second thing is doing the sort of more mindless part of the surgery in exactly the same way each and every time, draping the same way, putting your incisions in the same location, the lens you use, everything's so that you're saving your energy of when you have to make difficult decisions, intraoperative decisions and maneuvers, that you have all your energy and focus available to you for those relatively small number of minutes when it's really critical that you're going to be doing the real work of the surgery. And people, you know, I've always washed my hands the same way, prep draped the same way, and I would change things. You know, I used to tell the residents that if you don't do the stuff that we taught you here now, the first or second year out, I'll be really disappointed. But if you're doing everything the way we told you to do it 10 years from now, I'll be really disappointed, because you'll learn more and there'll be better innovations and so forth. I think a lot of it is recognizing, you know, it's there's this saying about Eleanor Roosevelt that she would rather light a candle than curse the darkness. And I think that was how I viewed surgery. Surgery wasn't really that well developed. Vitreoretinal surgery, when I started, it was people were just moving away from large single multifunction probes to, three port systems. I always used a three port system, but it was early in the development. For instance, we didn't have forceps for the retina at that time. I remember the Grieshaber rep came by and I said, "I have an idea. I have an idea for a tool for you." I said, "I want to create a forcep that, you know, will grab the tissue so we don't have to take a needle and bend the tip of the needle to peel an epiretinal membrane." So, well, there's this guy, Jeff Sullivan, he's a cataract surgeon in Australia, and he's made these capsulotomy forceps. Do you want to try them? And I said, "Well, if it already exists, great." And he gave it to me, and that was really the beginning of when people started using forceps rather than picks and bent needles to grab things. And I remember another time when I was trying to remove an intraocular foreign body, and in those days we would take this massive electromagnet and we would hold it outside the eye, we'd make a sclerotomy, and then you would say, "Turn on the magnet," and this piece of metal would fly across the eye. And I thought, "Oh my God, that is so grotesque." And so the first thing I did is I had Jean-Marie Parel make a small metal extension that you could screw on to the end of this, 10-pound electromagnet. And I said, and I the first case I did, I was sitting there and I made a sclerotomy, and I took this magnet and I had to hold it with two hands. It was so heavy. I put it in the eye and I could see that the tip was close to the metal, and I turned it on and the thing jumped, 2 or 3 millimeters and hit the tip, and I pulled it out, and my hands were shaking because I had tremors. It was so heavy. So I talked to Jean-Marie. I said, "There must be a better way." And they said, "Well, there's this rare earth, thing, and why don't we try making that?" And so it was just like, but everybody's been doing that, for years and years, for 20 years, and I guess nobody had really thought to maybe develop a magnet you could stick in the eye, and it wasn't a big deal. But you just sort of had to say, instead of bitching and moaning about it, do it. And then I was really opposed to posterior retinotomies in a way. We didn't have perfluorochemicals, obviously, and so you couldn't drive subretinal fluid out through the periphery. And so everybody was making posterior retinotomies to do retinal reattachment, with or without a buckle in those days. And I thought, well, what if we made this little What if we added silicone to the end of a tube and we put it on a little rollers, and we could then thread it through a peripheral hole, put it in the back of the eye, and then you wouldn't have to make a retinotomy and get the scarring and so forth. So we did that, and that we called that the snake. And by around that time, I was getting ready to leave Bascom Palmer, and I was friendly with Harry, and so. Flynn. And so I said, "Harry, I've got this thing. You try it if you like it, and we'll write it up together. And I'm ready. I'm already out the door on the way to Royal Oak." So we wrote it up, and that became the soft tip cannula. But it really was because, it wasn't. Everybody said, "Well, it works perfectly fine. You make a posterior retinotomy, and the fluid goes, and you laser it, and most of the time you don't get, a pucker or whatever." But a lot of stuff happened. There was a lot of morbidity associated with that, and so of course. That led to this, and then modifications were made of the snake, and so it became more common to be used. And then people started using it to obviously to smooth the retina out and to do a lot of other maneuvers. But I mean, it was just about recognizing limitations of the instrumentation that we had and saying what could we do to make it better, and instead of complaining about it. And I think that was the principle to me, was always to try to make things better, technically, either with tools or with maneuvers. So I don't know. But I think the most important principle is to respect the patient, make sure that if you're operating, it's for a good reason, and that the natural history without surgery is worse than the natural history with the surgery. And if you do that, and you're honest with the patients, it's a good thing. And I would say, I mean, the last point I'd say is it's better to do a little less than you need to do than more. And, Ron Michaels used to say, never lose an eye on the nasal side of the optic nerve, for work that you're doing on the nasal side of the optic nerve. Now, we do have better tools and for fluorochemicals and other things to be able to do all that, and we have tamponade. But in the old days, in the first years when I was operating, if you made a mistake, oftentimes it was fatal to the eye. We didn't even have an endo laser. We had a xenon arc, a photocoagulator. So you really had to develop good technique and try to really avoid iatrogenic complications and not say, oh, it's no big deal, we'll take care of that. But to really respect the tissue and to treat it, almost like a sacred tissue that you do everything you can to protect and to nurture back to health.
I think that's a really important principle that does somewhat get lost now because of all the advances. The eye has become a little bit more forgiving, but in the olden days, don't make a break meant something different than it means now. And so it's really great that you're bringing that forward. And frankly, we continue to teach it now. Our dear friend Buzz Krieger used to call it iatrogenicide. The people get in there and lose an eye, and so planning. Patient benefit, the ethics of having a clear discussion with a patient ahead of time, and making sure everybody's aligned and expectations are normalized. And then, of course, respecting the tissue and innovating. Those are fabulous lessons for people to take away and synthesize and think about in their own context. Let's shift gears for a second and talk about, you described a number of diseases that were unknowns, medical retinal diseases that were unknowns. At the time, take us through one of the stories, because that's such a thrill. And of course, it's not named Blumenkrantz syndrome, but I have a number of personal favorites, but I'm not gonna pollute this conversation with my bias. You go ahead and tell us your favorite or one of your favorite stories about that.
Well, I'll tell you one, and I guess it wasn't probably the very, very first report, but I think we did a lot of important work. Acute retinal necrosis was something that was really scary. I'll share a story with you. We'd started to see a few of these patients in Miami in the early 80s, and it was really a devastating disease. As we all know, it's a devastating disease, but it was really scary because we had no idea what was going on. These healthy people would come in and the retina turned white and the eyes were inflamed, and then 100% of them would detach, and you'd say, what is going on? There was never any risk factor, there was never anything, trauma, no infection, systemic infection. But we started lecturing about it, talking about it, myself and Bud Culbertson, I'd say mostly, and writing about it. So we started seeing more and more patients, and I was convinced that it was a viral disease, which sounds like a big deal, of course, but there was really not a consensus. In fact, a lot of people, including influential people, thought that it was was some sort of vasculitis, which it is a vasculitis, but it's secondary to an infection, of course. And finally, a patient came in who had really lost all vision in one eye. It was NLP, and the other eye was affected, and so he had bilateral acute ARN. So we talked to him. We said, well, we're gonna treat you, but best we can, but we can't save your other eye. And if we understood this disease better, maybe we'd be able to even treat you better, and certainly people in the future better, if we knew what was causing it, because there was no histology on the disease. And so we ended up enucleating the eye that was NLP. And we told the lab and the people in the building that we were going to be bringing that over to do culture and to inoculate a monkey. with the, with this tissue. And everybody was so frightened of his disease that we that a number of the lab techs didn't show up at the next day at the animal care facility to do that. And because I felt like we were carrying, you know, a nuclear waste, you know, with us. It was this horrible disease that would blind you if you caught it. So we went over and we were trying to inject this poor monkey, and a lot of, you know, drama going on. And Bud Culberson turned to me and he said, "We're more likely to inject ourselves than this monkey trying to sort of get it." And but we did, and we got the eye, and then we had the histology of the eye, of course. And we had removed some of it for, you know, to use this biologic material to see if we could culture a virus. We got the eye, and I you know got the I got the fins I got the thin sections for EM. And I went to the electron microscope one night. It was sort of like as soon as they came off the preparation, and I looked through the microscope, and I was just convinced that it was a virus by the way it behaved. But nobody had ever been able nobody knew. And I looked in and I saw herpes virus particles in the eye, and I knew I was the first person in the world to see this. And there wasn't anybody else in the building or in the room. It was night, you know, and I saw it, and it was just like, oh my God, this
Sort of like
is,
hat making a hole in one by yourself.
yeah, exactly. And I said, okay, that's it. This is a virus. Now we know how to treat it, you know. And I went around, but a lot of people didn't believe us, and they said, oh no, it's an artifact. And so we ended up sending sections around to other people who looked at them and still said, oh, I'm not so sure it's a virus. And other people said, well, this is a vasculitis. You need to treat it with steroids. And I said, nope. And we didn't have an antiviral. We only had, you know, we only at that point in time, I forget what it was something for CMV. But so I called up Burroughs Wellcome, and I knew they were working on acyclovir, and they were, but it hadn't been approved yet. And I said, would you send me some acyclovir? We have this really horrible viral disease down here, and I'd like to be able to treat the patients with this because we have nothing else to do for them. And they said they would. So they sent it down, and we used it, you know. And obviously, you needed more than acyclovir. You needed steroids after a while, and then laser, and then still sometimes I detached, and we described the use of acyclovir. And then we described you know, try to prevent detachments and how to treat the detachments when they occurred. But it was interesting, you know, about a couple of years later when HIV came along, and you know this from your time in LA, we didn't know what to do for it either. We didn't have a drug, and they remembered us from the time when I'd called up to get the acyclovir, and they said, we've got this drug BW759, what turned out to be ganciclovir, but it wasn't named yet. And they said, would you like to try using this on these CMV patients who have, we knew that those patients had CMV even before we knew ARN was caused by herpes simplex or zoster, because we'd seen it in organ transplant patients. So we got the drug, and we started using it, and we were one of the earliest places to do that too. So I that was one where I felt like I was right in the midst of this, you know, horrible thing. And then of course we ended up being a huge HIV center because Miami and Los Angeles and I guess New York were the three places. And so that's all we did.
Well, you probably remember this, but Rebecca, my wife, wrote the first paper when she was a medical student with Gary Holland describing CMV retinitis. And so it's it, but the thrill for you of that sort of detective story, trusting your hunch, thinking about things clearly, sticking to it, and then proving it, and then treating it, having the fortitude to go out and the initiative to go out and get the drug even before it was approved, and the knowledge that they were working on it is just remarkable, and what a huge contribution. So as we finish up in the last 10 minutes or so, I think I would be pilloried by our listening audience if I didn't ask you a couple questions about innovation. As our audience knows, you are the innovation guru in ophthalmology. You're the person that we all turn to mentor us and teach us how to innovate. And I've had the privilege of innovating side by side with you on a number of things, but let's talk about same sort of question. High-level principals, you have an innovation fellowship, an innovation institute, you've set up this national consortium on innovation, the CCOI. But let's talk about the principles of innovation. So many vitreoretinal surgeons, in fact, I dare say just about all vitreoretinal surgeons are super smart and to an extent pretty innovative. And we wonder, how do we unlock our innovation, our ideas, and how do we move them forward in a thoughtful way? So obviously we can't condense all of your knowledge on innovation into just a few minutes, but some high-level motivational, inspirational tips on how to chase our inner voices around innovation.
Yeah, well, there is one fundamental underlying principle that really is behind every successful innovation, and that is this concept of the unmet need. I mean, because we all sit around and we daydream and think about cool things. Wouldn't it be great if you could, I don't know, whatever. But and that's tantalizing because it's kind of narcissistic almost, that, oh, I've got this idea that, we're gonna find a new way to, to power a car or something like that. But we, I teach in the biodesign program at Stanford, and it's an underlying principle of that, which is that you start with an unmet need of this. If it's not, you can try. I mean, Steve Jobs was famous for creating reality distortion fields and telling people what they needed, and convincing them. And he was a great innovator, and he was also a great salesman. And
And
of course,
visionary.
a visionary. I mean, he's one of the best, and there are a bunch. But I think that in medical innovation, where you can't market your way to success, stuff's really got to work. That there has to be utility, and if you've got something that works, people in our field are reluctant to change because they get comfortable and they feel like it's safe. So really, the best innovation occurs where there's a recognized or sometimes unrecognized unmet need. Like the magnet, intraocular magnet, there just wasn't a good way to take care of. So it was an easy thing. Everybody started using the minute the rare earth magnet came out, had 100% market share because there wasn't anything else that did that, or acyclovir, or for retinal necrosis. There wasn't a drug, and all of a sudden there was a drug. But when people start getting into incremental improvements and things, a lot of people might not agree that there's a need, like to say that we need to go from, 800 cuts to 1200 cuts, or 1200 cuts to 2000 cuts, or 2000 cuts to 5000 cuts. People start saying, well, and people use all that in marketing claims and things, but really, one could argue that there isn't a need. It's there may be slightly better performance, but does that performance translate into meaningful improvements in outcomes? But if you're dealing with a disease that's untreatable, that everybody would agree that's an unmet need, and you've got to find a treatment for that. Or if you're dealing with a step in surgery where you just don't have a tool to do things like maybe grabbing a membrane rather than trying to use a needle and getting under it, I mean, that's an unmet need. Or trying to get rid of fluid underneath the retina, in the best possible way. Well, Helon kind of worked for people for giant tears, remember? Or people were on tilt tables. You turn upside down and you're lying on the floor, and fluid is dripping on your face, and you're wet, and you're trying to get an air bubble to move up. I mean, you and I lived through these times where, and so when perfluorocarbon came along, well, there was an unmet need. I mean, you didn't want to be upside down, and you didn't want to necessarily make a hole in the posterior retina to drain fluid. You could extrude it through a peripheral break. So those are the kind of things, or to have, to have an independent light pipe on one side as opposed to having it on the sleeve of a large multifunctional cutter. So I mean, if you think of all those things, or I mean, frankly, treatment laser treatments when they were, used with much greater frequency for treatment of diabetics. I mean, trying to put one spot in at a time was crazy. I mean, if you could put in You could put in 9 spots or 16 spots in the same amount of time. And then the thing about innovation is, meaning the best innovations are typically multidimensionally better than what you did. Like you can make a knife sharper, or you can make a cutter faster, or you can make a light a little brighter. But when you really come up with something that fundamentally changes the playing field, like the forward pass in football, I mean, it's everything's different, and like I'll give you an example. Like for the using pattern photocoagulation, the whole idea was to speed it up. That was the only thing, was speed it up. And if you speed it up, it's better for the doctor. Don't have to sit there for 3 sessions or 4 sessions. And the patient doesn't have to sit there. We didn't realize that the burns, so in order to speed it up, we had to shorten the pulse duration, because you couldn't sit there and do a 100 millisecond burn 16 times with a scanner. The patient would move. So we had to speed up the laser, and shorten the pulse duration to do that. And in doing that, we ended up getting better laser burns. There was less necrosis, less iatrogenic field loss. And then on top of that, it was less painful. I didn't know that if you used a shorter pulse duration, that it would hurt less. I just remember the first time I used it on a patient in Mexico, and the patient didn't seem to be squinting and moving. And I thought, that's funny. And then I asked him in Spanish, is it hurt? He says, well, not too bad. And then the next patient. Well, and what I'm driving at is that when an innovation is meaningful, it's typically better in many, many different ways. Maybe it costs less, maybe it hurts less, maybe it has fewer complications, maybe it has a higher success rate. Maybe, I mean, there and oftentimes the very best innovations do all of the above, right? And so I would say, you can't conquer the world the first time you try, but after a while, if you decide you're going to spend your time trying to innovate, make it worthwhile, not just for yourself, but for the patients and for other people, so that they say, geez, this is definitely a better way, and you're not relying upon a field rep to try to come in with all the supporting documentation to show that in a study, the success rate with this was 74%, and with the old therapy, the published studies they were only 68% or 62%. Everything, progress is always good, but I think progress really has to be meaningful and clinically meaningful. And you get into this whole issue when people publish papers nowadays, which is, statistical significance versus clinical significance. And I think that's really important. And I think the FDA pays attention to that. It really is important that you focus on what's important. And it's true in your whole life. Really spend your time really paying attention to things that are most important to you, and most important to your family, most important to your patients, most important to your colleagues. And if you work in those areas, and you are successful in what you're doing, the impact is so much greater, and the enjoyment factor and the respect that comes with that are so much more than just starting to figure out and a sort of to game coming up with a forcep with your name on it, or a method of inserting a lens or re extracting a lens or whatever. I think that utility, success is a byproduct of utility. If you come up with things that work and that create better outcomes, you'll be successful reputationally, economically, and from a personal satisfaction perspective. And that's what I think makes innovation so exciting and so worthwhile, is that not the sort of the notoriety or the fame, I suppose, that goes with it, but rather the fact that you're helping people, and that people like and appreciate that fact, and they look up to you for taking the time to do that, as opposed to maybe play another round of golf or see a few more patients or whatever. So I think it, and, but I do think that it's part and parcel of a whole package of things that you do to create a meaningful life for yourself, which includes family, includes your health, your fitness level, all the other things. Because I think if you don't take care of those things too, your family and and your friendships, it's harder to be productive, harder to do all these other creative, additional things, because you really aren't at your best. You're consumed with solving other problems, sort of, existential problems, that if they're not an issue for you, it allows you the freedom of mind, of choice, to do the things that where you really are more of a contributor, and with that goes a lot of personal satisfaction, and I would say happiness,
Mark, those are perfect words for us to end with. And I think giving back and taking care of those you love and those are including yourself and making a difference for patients, but giving back is the constant thread in all of our Giants in Retina series, and this one equally so. And so it's really rather interesting that this common thread is emerging of innovation, clinical care, contributions to the world at large and community as a method for achieving success. Really wonderful. And I can't thank you enough for sharing some of your story and encourage all of our audience to spend some time reading about Mark's contributions. It's everywhere once you start to look. We really didn't touch on the big data, gene therapy, cell therapy, novel biochemical compounds, antibodies, the contributions he's made across the valley with the household names, whether it's the brand of computer you're using or the operating system you're using, and the people he's trained who are bringing AI to the forefront. So, Mark, thank you on behalf of everyone at Retina Rounds and all our listeners for sharing your wisdom with us and some time together today. And thank you for all your contributions. And most importantly, thanks for your friendship, buddy.
If you enjoyed this video, please visit us at retinarounds.com. There you can sign up for our email list. You'll get a notification every time a new video is posted. And if you have an interesting video or a tip or trick that you'd like to share, please follow the links on our website and you can upload your video there. Thanks so much for watching.